Unlock the power of your mind. This is Provocative Enlightenment with Eldon Taylor.
Thank you for joining us today and welcome. This is an hour devoted to learning something more, not just about the world of shoes and ships and sealing wax, as my pretty bride likes me to say, but about how, what, and why we think and believe as we do. An hour for the open-minded, willing to challenge some of those old ideas behind what we think we know, who we are, and who we might become. I'm Eldon Taylor, and this is Provocative Enlightenment. All right, our chat room is open, and my partner, Ravinder, awaits you there now. You can log on by going to Eldon Taylor, that's ELDONTAYLOR.com/chat. So, Ravinder, say hello to the folks, and let us all know about your chat room and how our listeners can experience the chat, even when they're catching a replay.
Yeah, you can. You simply go to eldontaylor.com/chat in case you haven't heard that URL before. You can come join us while the show is live on the air. And, you know, we have some great conversation going on there. It adds an extra dimension to the show itself because we ask each other questions and get answers and feedback regarding it. But if you can't tune in live, you can always hit the replay for any time during the following week. So come in and check it out.
You know, another thing that happens to the chat room is that sometimes we can be short time, and taking a phone call can, you know, you don't have the time for that. But a question that's come up in the chat room, you're posting to me, and it, you know, quick questions. I often can get a chat room question on where we don't have the time to take an actual phone call. That's so. True. Do join her in the chat room. Every week I read some of your letters as our way of paying respect to the very important role you play in making this show successful. Last week our show featured Dr. Darren Weissman, and we discussed his upcoming book and healing techniques. Gwyneth wrote, "Thanks for the informative show today." LaCree wrote, "Great show." Judy wrote, "Love Darren Weissman and Eldon Taylor." John wrote, "I have a hard time believing that the bang bang treatment Weissman gave your caller really worked to remove her fears. It sounded more like a brainwashing technique. I would have loved to have you question the caller afterwards about her fears with an eye to whether or not they remained. Do you really believe this rat-a-tat-tat approach works to eliminate deep-seated problems just like that?" Well, the answer in one word, John, is no. Now, that does not condemn the approach. It simply states that deep-seated issues are unconscious in nature and almost always, until they are made fully conscious, will continue to exert both force and power over our thinking and behavior. Further, just knowing that we made maladaptive choices at an early age, and even knowing what those choices are, does not necessarily relieve us of the burden they place upon our psyche. Now, we're all familiar with what is termed ANTS, automatic, negative thoughts. These thoughts are reflections on our adaptations and beliefs. They are not easily eliminated by simple affirmations. Indeed, the hard data suggests that your defense mechanisms, that conscious sentry in your mind, will mitigate whatever affirmation you consciously speak to yourself with its own series of ANTS. Add to this the stratification of the various defense mechanisms, their strategies, and how they have been built up to deal with the issue, and I tend to believe that what you heard was a very good starting point. All right, moving on. Maud Girl wrote, "I was blessed with both Eldon's Inner Talk CD and Dr. Weissman's book as gifts when I had a head injury a few years back. Sometimes the release was so amazing I cried in joy." Monica wrote, "Dear Eldon, I can't tell you how grateful I am to have discovered you, your books, and especially your wonderful CDs. We have purchased over 70 of them over the past 6 months or so and have found them to be extraordinary. The growth and movement we have experienced has been remarkable and remarkably easy compared to the long and arduous road we have traveled in our search for self-awareness and healing." Well, thank you very much, Monica. Now, how do you like that one, Ravinder, for a new warm fuzzy?
I like my warm fuzzies.
You like? Okay. Linda wrote, "Love these CDs. They are a great help to my son in med school and my daughter doing grad work at Columbia." Janet wrote, I am currently penniless and grateful for your mind book, listening to the Serenity CD over and over. I start a new job in the fall and thank you for the free self-help items until I can afford to purchase more. Katie K. wrote, thank you for making these available and for all you do. You're awesome. Now listen, what Janet and Katie K. are talking about is our free InterTalk programs that we make available as just a part of our own Pay It Forward program. They are not samples. They are the real deal, the patented and scientifically proven effective InterTalk technology. Double-blind study after double-blind study carried out by independent researchers at leading universities such as Stanford, for that matter by governments, have repeatedly validated the power and effectiveness of InterTalk. So don't delay. Get yours today. Just go to InterTalk, InterTalk.com, and choose free programs from the left-hand navigation pane. It's really that simple. All right, that's all the time we have for letters today, but I do invite you to opine by sending your email to Eldon@EldonTaylor.com or by joining me on Facebook. We can't get all of your letters on the air, but they do impact our programming, and once again, I both appreciate and thank you for your feedback and continued support. Now to today's show, Wabi-Sabi Love, the ancient art of finding perfect love in imperfect relationships, with the author, Ariel Ford. Quoting Ariel, after joyous beginnings, many couples find their dreams of perfect love replaced by frustration, criticism, defensiveness, and emotional distance. Yet the key to enduring love lies not in chasing an ideal, close quote. Lasting love, therefore, seems to require that we embrace the very flaws, quirks, and differences that make each of us unique. Now, wabi-sabi is an interesting term. Wabi-sabi represents a comprehensive Japanese worldview, or ascetic, centered on the acceptance of transience and imperfection. The ascetic is sometimes described as one of beauty that is, quote, imperfect, impermanent, and incomplete, close quote. It is a concept derived from the Buddhist teaching of the three marks of existence, specifically impermanence, the other two being suffering and emptiness, of absence of self-nature, of course. Pared down to its barest essence, what wabi-sabi is the art of finding beauty in imperfection and profundity in nature, of accepting the natural cycle of growth, decay, and death. It's simply slow and uncluttered, and it reveres authenticity above all. All right, let me introduce our guest. Ariel Ford is a nationally recognized love expert and author of Wabi-Sabi Love and the bestseller, The Soulmate Secret, Manifest the Love of Your Life with the Law of Attraction. She is a nationally recognized publicist and marketing expert and television producer. As the president of the Ford Group, Ariel is best known for helping launch the careers of many best-selling authors. For more than 15 years, Ariel was one of America's top book publicists, representing many New York Times number one authors, including Deepak Chopra, Wayne Dyer, Dean Ornish, Neil Donald Walsh, Gary Zukav, and Don Miguel Ruiz, to name a few. She opened this year with this post, quote, I am super optimistic about 2013 as I plan to focus on spaciousness, self-care, and transforming my response to stress from panic to pleasure. My current favorite quote is, being realistic is just socially acceptable pessimism, close quote. I happen to like that. I think that's a really good one. She is a prominent author as well. Does a really great blog that I follow myself at the Huffington Post. You don't want to miss that. So let's get her in here. Welcome to Provocative Enlightenment, Ariel Ford.
Hi, Eldon. How are you?
I am excellent. Now, listen, the last time you were scheduled for the show several weeks ago, we had to cancel due to the loss of your sister, Debbie.
Yeah.
So to begin, we want to personally express our appreciation for everything you and Debbie have given and continue to give to the world. We were all saddened to hear of Debbie's departure, and we all offer our love and support to you, for you and yours as you adjust to her physical absence. But, you know, we also believe that she's still here in spirit. It would be unfair of me not to give you an opportunity to comment on her passing, and so would you like to make some comment on that subject today before we begin?
Oh, well, thank you. Yeah, it's quite an adjustment, but, you know, she's a very bright light and a big spirit, and she's been busy visiting me in my dreams and talking to people she knows and people she doesn't know and coming through with all kinds of wisdom. So, From what I understand, she plans to continue teaching from the other side, and we'll see how that works out. But yeah, thank you so much.
Well, indeed. Okay, you heard the setup piece. Did the definition I provide of wabi-sabi fit your scheme as it relates to love? And indeed, please unpack your idea of what wabi-sabi love is for us.
Sure. So, as you mentioned, wabi-sabi is an ancient Japanese aesthetic that seeks to find beauty and perfection in imperfection. So one of the easiest ways to think about it is, imagine you had a big vase with a long, crooked crack down the middle of it. The Japanese would take this broken, cracked vase, place it on a pedestal, and then shine a spotlight on the crack. So with wabi-sabi love, what we seek to do is find the beauty and perfection in our own cracks, and especially those of our mates. And what happens frequently is that, you know, people get together and they fall in love and they have this honeymoon phase, but then slowly real life seems to creep in, and the stuff that we once found enchanting and adorable about them is now driving us crazy. So with wabi-sabi love, it's a way to shift your focus and your perspective so that you can love your mate all of the time for exactly who they really are, because that's all we all really want. We want to be loved and accepted for who we most are. Now, there is a place where this doesn't work. If there's any abuse or addiction or bad behavior in your relationship, you can't wabi-sabi your way out of it. You need professional help. But for most general annoyances, there are wabi-sabi solutions. And if you like, I have lots of stories I can share about that.
You know, and I do want to get into those stories. But you know what occurs to me is, you know, I have a friend whose wife apparently decorates their bathroom counter with toothpaste. And so every morning when he goes in, he's wiping off the counter because it's got toothpaste on it. And I'm thinking, you know what I'm going to tell him is, why don't you put a spotlight on that and just shine it on the toothpaste? Let it kind of harden. I mean, that's your analogy of the vase, I'm sorry, did remind me of the toothpaste
well,
on the counter.
I'm glad you brought up the toothpaste because that's actually one of my favorite stories that's not even in the book. I'm one of these people that when I get out my tube of toothpaste, I squeeze it from the bottom very neatly and I roll it up. My husband, on the other hand, is a mangled from the middle guy. He goes in and he grabs a tube of toothpaste and he squeezes it hard from the middle. And then when I go in to brush my teeth, I was always looking at this crumpled tube and I'd have this bad feeling like, why can't he just do it right? Why does he have to make it look so bad? What's the matter with him? And this went on for a few years. Every time I saw the toothpaste, I'd have a bad thought and a bad feeling about the person I most loved. So one day, I decided to figure out the wabi-sabi solution, you know, and I held this mangled tube of toothpaste in the palm of my hand, and I kept looking at it, saying to myself, what's good about this? Tell me something good about this. And then finally, it dawned on me, thank God I married a man who brushes his teeth. And okay. Now, every time I see the mangled tube of toothpaste, I smile because my new meaning about it is that we're going to grow old together and he's still going to have all of his teeth.
Cool. Okay, now listen.
So that's a wabi-sabi shift in perception.
It is.
Take the thing that once annoyed you, and you go from annoyed to enjoyed.
I like that. Now, as the author of The Soulmate Secret, Manifest the Love of Your Life with the Law of Attraction, can you flesh out how the concepts of attraction, soulmates, and wabi-sabi dovetail? I mean, many people believe that their soulmate is their perfect match, and as a result, you know, they expect them to perform in ways. So, well, let's just say they're not prepared for wabi-sabi opportunities.
Right.
In fact, we've got some so-called gurus who've announced their soulmate, married their soulmate, divorced their soulmate, found another soulmate, and they have serial soulmates. So how does that work?
Well, there's about 9 questions in there. So let's start with the word perfection. Okay, so we have all been brainwashed by the media and society to seek perfection in ourselves and our kids, our careers, and our mates. HGTV would like us to have the perfect homes. And I believe the word perfection needs to be changed to pure fiction because it doesn't exist. And when we're seeking perfection, we end up, you know, upset, frustrated, disappointed because we're going after something that doesn't exist that we can't have. So that's the first part of it, perfection. Now, in terms of a soulmate is not a perfect person, but they are the perfect person for you. So that's the difference. So, yes, you can manifest a soulmate, but if you have delusions that everything's going to be easy all the time and everything's going to be peachy, well, you're just crazy. That's not the way the world works. In fact, Dr. John Gottman, who's one of the leading researchers on marriage, says that every relationship, every marriage has at least 9 irreconcilable differences, and that's normal. So you're never going to agree on everything, and you're not supposed to agree on everything, which is why learning how to be a wabi-sabi love artisan is so important, because you can learn to find love and laughter and lightheartedness in things that you're now choosing to drive you crazy. Because the truth is, you know, Ravinda didn't wake up this morning saying, gee, I wonder how I could make Eldon really nuts today. You know, what's the thing I could do that would really annoy him and get under his skin?
You don't know her very well, do you?
You want to bet, Ariel.
Nobody's thinking that way. Nobody's waking up saying, how can I annoy my spouse? We're all doing the best we can. And the truth is, if she is doing something or you're doing something that's annoying her, chances are it's really her problem or your problem because you're the one who's having the reaction to it. I'll give you a for instance. In our house, the washer and the dryer is in the dining room of all places, and it has these doors. So I like that cover them up. I like to keep the doors closed all the time because I don't want to look at the washer dryer. Brian, who happens to do the laundry in our house, is always leaving the doors open. And for years, it drove me crazy. And then I realized, you know what? It doesn't bother him. It's not his problem. It's my problem. So as soon as I see it, I close the drawer, you know, close the doors. I happen to leave drawers open. I don't mean to leave them open. I just never close them completely. So he just walks around after me closing them. Now, he could say, why can't you close the drawer properly? Which he did for years. But then one day he just figured out, oh, you know what? You have a blind spot when it comes to this. I'm just going to do it for you. And I know that sounds really simple, but if you add up all the little things that get on your nerves and you decide to take personal responsibility for them, it's the end of the problem.
You know, you just described my household. I do the laundry and close her drawers.
I was just about to say, I have finally discovered the secret to the perfect marriage. And that is when the husband does the laundry. I talk to lots of people, and I keep encountering the people who have the best relationships. The husband does the laundry, and I used to leave all the drawers
open,
sorry.
Too. I'm not going to get behind that one, folks.
There's a company called Bosch. It's spelled B-O-S-C-H. They make kitchen appliances.
Mm-hmm.
And they recently did a study, and they found out the number one thing that couples fight about is how to load the dishwasher. Because some people like to put the silverware points up, and some like to put it points down, and some like to put the dishes really close together, and some like space between the dishes. And people have these huge arguments over it. You know, it's crazy. You could just decide, you know what, who is it more important to? Like for Brian, he likes the points down because he thinks it's safer. I like them up because I think they'll get cleaner. But you know what? It's not worth fighting over.
You know, she's describing our household again.
She really is. And when it comes to the dishwasher, see, I follow the instructions in the manual. They tell you which direction to point everything.
Oh, what do they say?
That's what I do. Everything is supposed to point inwards. When my husband does it, he points everything outwards, and it used to drive me nuts until I started paying attention to how the dishes were coming out. And his success rate of getting everything clean in the dishwasher was better than mine. So now I'm copying him.
So there's your wabi-sabi on that
one. I'm telling you, listen, this stuff really works. Right now, 50% of first marriages, 67% of second marriages, and a whopping 74% of third marriages end in divorce, okay? Because
right.
we're constantly picking each other apart and whining and complaining, which doesn't work. You know, just find a fun way to deal with it. I'll give you a quick example. One day early in our marriage, I was standing in front of Brian. I had my left hand on my left hip and my right index finger wagging in his face, and I was carrying on about God knows what. I don't know what I was upset about. And as I stood there, I witnessed what I was doing, and I stopped, and I said to him, you know, the next time this happens, and unfortunately there's probably going to be a next time, could you just kindly, gently, sweetly say to me, when did Sheila enter the room? Now, Sheila is my mother's name, and I love my mother to death. She's the coolest woman I know. But she can be a little bossy and overbearing. And Brian got it instantly, and he said, yes, and the next time I'm too patronizing, you can call me Wayne. That was his dad's name. So very, very quickly, we went from what could have been World War III to creating these very fun and funny code names for each other, so that the next time I was getting really bossy, he just looked at me and smiled and said, oh, I see Sheila's here. And we had this instant wabi-sabi way to diffuse a difficult situation.
That's cool. You know, your literature talks about an epiphany that Barack and Michelle Obama had, like 5 a.m. in the morning, I believe is what you say. Tell us about that epiphany. We've got,
sure.
still got a couple of minutes.
This is a true story. So, what most people don't know is that about 12 years ago, Barack and Michelle almost got divorced. She had this very big corporate job. They had two little girls at home. They were drowning in debt from their Ivy League law school careers, and they weren't getting along. In fact, Barack had told his grandmother that Michelle was nagging him all the time. Michelle had told her mother she didn't think they were going to make it. So one morning, she wakes up at 5 in the morning, and all she could think about was that she really wanted to go to the gym and work out. She hadn't had time to work out in months. But then, you know, she was feeling guilty that the girls were going to get up and they were going to need breakfast. And anyway, she finally looked at Barack, who was sound asleep, and she thought, you know what? He's got an Ivy League education. He'll figure out breakfast. So she gets out of bed, goes to the gym. It's 5:30 in the morning. As she's working out, she's thinking about their relationship and their life together and how things aren't going well, and she realizes that she has been waiting for Barack to make her happy. And she sees in that moment that it's up to her to make herself happy. So she goes home, and of course she sees the girls with their dad at the kitchen table having cereal. He's figured out breakfast, and she announces to them the new Obama family rules. Rule number one, she's finally going to take her mother up on the offer to help her out with the shopping and the cleaning and the driving of the kids. And rule number two, she tells Barack, every night that he's in town, they're having dinner together as a family at 6:30. Rule number three, every Thursday night is date night. And rule number four, every Sunday is family day. And that was the day she decided to take personal responsibility for her own happiness and that of her family. And as we all know now, despite of whatever your politics are, they are soulmates, they love each other, they're in the White House, grandma's there with them, and it's all working out because Michelle decided that she would take control of her own life.
And fortunately, President Obama said, well, the wabi-sabi side of this is I guess she can be the boss and tell us what the itinerary is. Because not every man would accept that. We have a hard break coming up. So when we come back, we'll pick this up. And I want to hear some more stories, but I have several more questions for you, Ariel. We're speaking about wabi-sabi love, the ancient art of finding perfect love in imperfect relationships with author Ariel Ford. If you're not already in our chat room, now's a great time to join in the conversation. We have a short movie of our guest, and you'll want to see it. So stay tuned. You don't want to miss what's coming up after a few words from some of our friends.
Unlock the power of your mind. This is Provocative Enlightenment with Eldon Taylor.
And welcome back. If you just joined us, we're speaking with Ariel Ford about wabi-sabi love, the ancient art of finding perfect love in imperfect relationships. And I have to tell you, it is a great read. It is a great book. It is very real. And it's one, you know, this is a subject both Ravinder and I love. But before we get back to the show, I want to invite you to join me on Facebook as a friend or a fan. I post regularly everything from where I am and what's on next to the latest in science, technology, and consciousness studies, and from time to time, some of my own opinions about the world we live in. I also want to remind you to be sure and register to receive my free newsletter when you visit my site and you get your free MP3. All right, let's get back to the show. We had a wonderful story about Michelle and Barack Obama before we went to break. So I've got a question for you, Ariel. You obviously believe that perfectionism, as you say, is pure fictionism. I'm kind of playing with your words there. So if you go in expecting that, then I guess you're also implying you have a dead end to happiness. Is that true?
Yes, I think that is true. And, you know, one of the things that has been researched at the University of Buffalo is rose-colored glasses. They have discovered that couples who consciously put on rose-colored glasses have deeper, happier, more satisfying relationships. And the reason for this is because when you're idealizing your partner, you're focusing on what's right and not on what's wrong. They actually also call this the Pygmalion effect. It's the phenomenon in which the greater the expectation placed upon someone, the better they perform. Mm-hmm. And you and I might call this a self-fulfilling prophecy. So, you know, as mature adults, since we get to choose our thoughts and beliefs, why wouldn't we intentionally intend and expect the best out of ourselves and out of our partners?
That's true. Now, you kind of touched on this, but I know you're familiar with Beatty's codependence work. And, and of course, you know, sometimes codependence arises as a result of a chemical dependency or there's abuse involved, etc. But there are other kinds of codependence. There's that kind of codependence that, you know, if you loved me, you would do this. The implied bargaining, if you will. Mm-hmm. How do you interface wabi-sabi? How do you, or do you juxtapose it with codependent relationships? Kind of flesh that area out for us, will you?
You know, I'm not sure I'm the right one to figure that piece out of it because I'm not a therapist or a shrink. You know, for me, I think there's a healthy interdependence, you know, where we're both on the same team. We want the best for each other. We support each other. And, you know, there may be a little codependency in there, but, you know, I kind of like Harville Hendrick's approach to all of this. You know, he says that any form of criticism is a form of violence, and that if you need to give your partner some kind of feedback, you first want to give them lots of positive feedback. And then what, you know, and in fact, John Gottman says that the magic number is five pieces of positive feedback. And then you, in the nicest, most loving way possible, give them the other piece. Because Harville Hendrick says there is no such thing as constructive criticism. You know, so I think that there's a way in which we can, you know, join up, love each other, support each other, be each other's biggest cheerleaders. And then sometimes, you know, you got to have those deeper conversations where, you know, like, listen, honey, I love you to pieces. You just did A, B, C, and D, which was great. And here's how I felt when you did X, Y, and Z. And I know you didn't mean to hurt me, and I'll even take 50% responsibility for, you know, what's happened here. But how can we change this? How can we make this better?
You know, I like your general message, and within couples, maybe the absence of construct. I guess where I am is I reject the notion that there's no such thing as constructive criticism. And I hate to do that, but criticism is either going to be negative or it's going to be intended with the highest best. And if it's intended with the highest best, isn't that what constructive means?
You know, I haven't given it all that much thought. I don't really know. I would say, you know, for myself, I tend to get defensive. So if you're going to tell me something I don't really want to hear, you better do it in a really sweet way. So
yeah, I like the idea of 5-to-1. That's good.
Yeah, or what they call, you know, the Oreo technique. You know, a little love here, a little dissonance here, a little love on the other side.
Right.
But I think you got to set people up to win. You know, to let them know that, listen, I love you. I'm your best friend. I'm here for you. And I see that what you're doing about A, B, and C isn't really supporting you in the highest way possible, and I want to talk to you about it.
Yeah, and now, see, I would see that as constructive criticism and a perfect example of how you might introduce a subject that would enable the person you love to appreciate themselves and life more, or at least introduce the ideas so that they could weigh it, evaluate it, discard it, or do whatever they wanted to do with it.
Yeah. And maybe that is just the best definition of constructive criticism. Next time I talk to Harville, I'll ask him what his definition is. I'll get back
okay.
to you on that.
Well, that's good. All right. What about our partner consistently doing something that truly makes us crazy? I mean, you know, and your toothpaste analogy is a good one, but it's also, well, I hope whoever I married will brush their teeth because I plan on kissing them.
Well, let me tell you another story. So I have these
please
friends,
do.
Ed and Deb. And Ed is this big teddy bear of a guy. And Deb is this real sort of, you know, make a list, cross it off, get it done, buy the book kind of gal. And they've been married for 15 years. But the one thing that really drives Deb crazy is that Ed is always holding her up. So, for instance, they were at the bank the other day, and they were standing in line waiting for a teller. And Deb's tapping her foot and getting impatient because she's got other things she wants to get done today. Finally, the teller opens up. She turns around to grab Ed. What's Ed doing? He's talking to the 8-year-old little girl standing behind him. And Deb hears him say to the little girl, "What did the baby strawberry say to its mother?" The little girl looks up and says, "Well, I don't know." And Ed says to her, "Mama, I'm in a jam." And the little girl laughs and her mother laughs. And Deb, she's pissed off. She's grabbing Ed by, you know, the scruff of his neck, pulling him over to the teller. So they finish their banking. They go outside. They cross the street to go to the farmer's market because Deb wants to buy salad fixings for lunch. And she's looking at the lettuce and the tomatoes and the cucumbers. She turns around to talk to Ed. Ed's gone. So she goes looking for Ed. Where does she find him? He's sitting on the curb with a 10-year-old little boy who looks like he's totally depressed and miserable. She walks over. She hears Ed say to the boy, "How does a camel hide in the desert?" And the kid, like, looks up. "I don't know. Camouflage!" And the kid laughs, and he smiles for the first time in days, and his mother's happy. And Deb, what is Deb doing? She's crying. Why is she crying? Because for the first time in 15 years, she finally gets that Ed isn't waking up in the morning telling these dumb jokes to make her crazy. Ed just wants to make people smile. He just wants to bring light and love wherever he goes. And then she fell in love with her husband all over again.
That's a cool story. I like that story.
And you probably know them. It's Ed and Deb Shapiro. That's their story.
I love your book, and I love your approach, and maybe because I was excited about talking to you about this material and getting into some of these stories, sharing them with our audience, I neglected to ask you a question that I'm being prompted out of our chat room right now to ask. And Dee Wallace and I had a conversation, and it's all about the song of your life. Dee believes that we should all have a song that is the song of our life. So Celestial is asking me from the chat room, be sure to ask Ariel what her song of life is.
Oh, easy. Defying Gravity.
Defying Gravity. That's your song of life?
From Wicked. Well, that's my favorite song.
Oh, wow. Okay. Defying Gravity. It's too bad I don't have that cued where I can play a little bit of it. Defying Gravity. What makes that your song?
I just love it that, you know, that no matter what's going on in your life, you have the power to fly, that you can defy gravity, that you don't have to be held down by other people or ideas, that you can just spread your wings and go.
You rise above it all. I love it. All right. Let me ask you this. You recommend creating code words like you expressed that you and your husband share.
Mm-hmm.
Playful reminders. Can you give us a couple of more examples of how you might do that?
Yeah. You know, I have some other friends that have three portable phones in their house, and they're in a three-story house. And every time the husband goes to look for a phone, it's never in the cradle. So he calls his wife the phone burglar, because she's always taking the phones. You know, it used to make him crazy, like, Joni, where's the phone? Now he just sneaks up on her and goes, phone burglar, what'd you do with the phone? You know, and which is a much sweeter approach than yelling at her, going, you know, where's the you-know-what phone? So it's just a way to be more playful. If they're doing something that you don't like, it's just a playful reminder. Make up a name for them. Give them a nickname, but make it fun.
Do you find that when you talk to people about doing this kind of thing that there's any initial resistance to the idea? Because, I mean, you know, usually you're perturbed at a behavior. And so trying to, you know, introduce levity into that.
Yeah, it's,
you know,
not an instantaneous process. It's not going to happen in the moment. So the thing to do is, if you notice that it's, you know, you have this ongoing thing, somebody's always misplacing something, you know, you need to first calm yourself down, get into your little toolkit of EFT or whatever it is that you use to calm yourself with, and then try and be creative with it. You know, just try to really think, well, you know, what could I do that would be fun for me and fun for her, fun for him, that could be a reminder, oh, you know, once again, you left a wet towel on the floor, you know, if the wet towel's driving you crazy, you know. I remember there was a time when it wasn't Brian, but it was somebody else that I was living with a long time ago, always used to leave the toilet seat up, which, you know, in the middle of the night meant that I was falling into the toilet, which was not fun. So finally, I used to close it all the way, close the lid. So when he opened up the lid, there was a yellow Post-it note with a bribe in it. If you promise to put the toilet seat down, I will do A, B, and C for you. And I made it fun. So every time he went into the bathroom, there was a new note there. And eventually, he got trained to put the toilet seat down. But yelling at him didn't work. Complaining about it didn't work. Making it fun worked.
The operative word there is, of course, trained. I often say my wife has trained me, you know. In all these stories that you're telling, there is a level of responsibility that you're taking. And in the instance with your husband, you recognize the behavior, the Sheila behavior, and that's behavior you don't want to manifest. And so it's easy for you to say, oh, whoops, I'm sorry. You know, whenever you see this, remind me of it. Okay.
Yeah.
How do you, you know, your story about the toilet, I suppose, is a pretty good example of coming from the other direction, where what you're trying to do is impress another person that, you know, gosh, it'd be just a lot easier if you would change a given behavior. But at the same time that you're teaching this person, you're training this person, you also say you can't change another person. the change has to be about you. Can you, you know, balance that for me?
Well, you know, I don't think it's always black and white. You know, in most cases, I really believe you have to take personal responsibility for the thing that's making you crazy and make up a new story about it so that it's fun for you. And in some cases where it has, you know, a potentially cold and wet reality to it, like the toilet seat, you know, that's why I say pick your battles, you know. So I'm not going to try and change Brian 90% of the time, but on something like this, where it's just, you know, really going to disrupt my life, I'll find a fun way to change it. You know, I mean, it's not that we're completely unchangeable. I just think, you know, you don't want to be constantly whining, bitching, and complaining about stuff that you can find a different solution for.
One of the chapters that I enjoyed most about your book discusses a subject that I just don't think that we hear enough of, particularly in relationships. And that's the subject of humility.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us all how humility enters into making a relationship work.
Well, you know, who wants to be hanging out with somebody who's stuck up and arrogant, right? We don't want to be there. And the story that that I really enjoyed most from that chapter was about my friend Jill, who had been engaged the same guy for 2 years, and every time I kept saying, well, when's the wedding, and she would just say, well, you know, I'm just not sure when the wedding's going to be, because she really saw herself as spiritually advanced to him, because she wore organic cotton, she was a vegan, she did yoga every day, she prayed and chanted, and he was a motorcycle riding, hunting kind of guy. So after a couple of years, they decided to become unengaged, but they continued to live together because of the economy. And then Jill got really sick, and Ray nursed her back to health. And one morning when she was back in the kitchen, he came walking in through the back door with his dog and his rifle and a couple of dead turkeys. And she said to him, well, how was your morning? And he said, well, I was up before the sun rose, and I was walking through the forest, and then the sun came up, and the light was filtering through the leaves, and I could hear the leaves crunching under my feet. And she said, wow, it sounds like quite a spiritual experience. And he said, well, I guess you could say that. And then he came home from work a few days later, and he was very upset because his boss at the motorcycle repair shop had just suddenly died of a heart attack. And he said to Jill, the funeral's in a couple of days, and you know how uncomfortable I am in public places. Would you go to the funeral with me? So she said, yes, of course. They went to the funeral. There was a whole eulogy done, a whole service. And at the end, the officiant said to this packed room of 300 people, is there anybody who would like to speak on behalf of Bob, the guy who died? And nobody moved. Nobody got up. Nobody was walking to the front of the room. So Ray, Jill's ex-boyfriend, walks to the front of the room and gives this whole impromptu talk about what a good man Bob was, what a good father, a good boss, a good friend. And Jill is like in tears. She can't believe that this is the guy that she's been judging all these years is breaking through his barriers and doing all of this. And she finally realizes, with great humility, that she had been the spiritually arrogant one, that she had been judging Ray as not spiritual because he didn't practice her brand of spirituality, that even though he was a hunter, he did it with a form of sacredness, and even though he didn't do yoga, he had his own kind of spirituality to him. So that's the kind of humility we talk about in Wabi Sabi Love.
And that's a very, very important, I think, message contained in there. It has to do with our judgment. We arrogate to ourselves an understanding, and we often call that just ego, that is very often totally erroneous. So combine then humility and this notion of surrender that you talk about.
Mm. Well, you know, for me, surrender has a lot of different meanings, but for me, the biggest meaning is giving up control and giving up the need to control anybody else or anything. that when I trust in my own process and when I trust that I'm co-creating my life with God or Goddess or the universe or whatever you want to call it, then there is no need to push and control, that I can rest in the knowingness that who I am and what I have is enough, and that I am deserving of having and desiring and receiving all that is meant to be mine. Does that make sense?
It does. It makes perfect sense. In your relationship, the fact that you're deserving all of this, how do you see your mate as providing it to you, or do you?
You know, I think it's sort of both for me. You know, I believe that and it took me years to learn this, and it was really Louise Hay that helped me learn this by doing mirror work back in the late 80s. I actually did sessions with her where I learned to love and appreciate myself. And as I learned to love and appreciate myself, then I could receive love from others. You know, so as long as I am in this knowing and feeling state that I deserve to receive love, then my partner can contribute love to me. So it becomes a both-way street.
There is a wisdom out there, and I don't know how wise it is. I'm going to let you comment on that. But, you know, one of those sayings that essentially goes, you know, I want the highest best for this person because I love them. I love them unconditionally. So if that means they need to be somewhere else with someone else, then I let them go in love. Where are you on that?
You know, that's a hard one for me because, you know, I do believe that if somebody doesn't want to be with you, you need to let them go. And then the really human part of me is like, no, stay. How could I change? So hopefully I won't have to confront that, but I realize how hard that is for people.
So the wabi-sabi approach to that is...
You know, I actually have to admit, I've never thought about this, so I don't really know what the wabi-sabi approach to that is.
Well, it's my job to get you to think about these things live, isn't it? You know what? You have a super special opportunity out there right now. I discovered it today on Amazon. Your book is available on Kindle at a special price. Tell us all about that.
Yes, Amazon.com and BarnesandNoble.com and iTunes have the electronic version, the Kindle version of Wabi Sabi Love for $2.99 now through May 6th. And I can't even believe they're doing that. $2.99. So, you know, I would think that if you're in a relationship, you've got to be willing to spend $2.99 to figure out how to have more fun with it.
You know, if you're not willing to spend $2.99, you don't belong in the relationship, period. That's my view. I have your hardback. It's $24.99. It's worth every bit of that. It is a marvelous read, and I'd highly recommend it to everybody. In about 1 minute that we have left, Ariel, please tell everybody how they can learn more about you, your website, your Huffington Post blogs, et cetera, and so
sure.
forth.
Sure. Well, the easiest way to find me is at wabisabilove.com, and you can get a free chapter of the book there, or if you go to wabisabilove.com/gifts, there's a 5-part free video series and some free ebooks. Or if you're single and you're looking to manifest love, go to soulmatesecret.com. And I'm on Facebook as well. So those are the two best places to start, wabisabilove.com and soulmatesecret.com.
And your word of the day then, in departing, your final message to our listening audience?
Wabi-sabi.
Wabi-sabi. I love it. It is indeed a great book. Ravinder, you love this message, right?
I do. You know, we have been asked so many times what the secret is with our relationship, and I think... time and time again through this conversation, Ariel is just smacking it on the head. It's like, that's right. It's real. You know, the idea of the perfect soulmate and everything is going to be wonderful forevermore doesn't exist.
That's right.
It doesn't exist.
Well, I don't know about that. You're rather perfect, and it sounds like Ariel is as well. But, you know, I love vases with cracks. That's a joke.
Well, you know what? Let me just leave you with one line from Sam Keane.
Very quick.
We come to love not by finding a perfect person, but by learning to see an imperfect person perfectly.
I love it. I love it. All right. I want to thank you for joining us today. All of you, Ariel, you're a wonderful guest, as you well know. I want to thank the team at Hay House for producing this show and making it so pleasurable. Remember, wherever you are in the world, believing in yourself always matters.